Okay, we are in week number 66, pages 924 through 939 in the Chronological Study Bibles. Is there anybody that does not have a copy? Good, because we don't have an extra copy. I just noticed that's what I was asking. I looked down there, like, wasn't picked up, so we're in good shape, though. But we are in Job, and that is the last about third, a little less than a third, I guess, of the book. Some 17 chapters, 26 through 42, which I think tonight I'm sort of going to attack from the end and work backwards in a little sense. What the book of Job is about, to just approach it from a different standpoint, is that it is the great trial. And there's a bunch of different people that are on trial in the book of Job. And it's as if each witness comes forward, each witness testifies, they present all their best argumentation. And what we've got there first is that Job is being tried by Satan. Satan is making accusations against him. Satan wants to convict him of being only in it for the profit. He'll serve God, that's P-R-O-F-I-T. He's only going to serve God if it pays off. And the Lord, of course, is pointing out that is not the case. It is true. He's been highly blessed. He's the greatest of all the men of the East at this time. He's vastly wealthy. He's happy as he can be. All is going well. But it is not so that he would only serve God because it's going well. And so God allows Satan to put Job to the test. Satan is trying Job. Then, throughout the book, God is also on trial by Job. Job is extremely careful about how he does this, but he's also very firm that what is taking place is not right. He has not deserved this. The suffering that he's enduring is not because of any failure or misbehavior on his part. He cries out in a wide range of ways about this fundamental fact, about how you can't know what God is doing with you, for instance. But he is saying, God, this isn't right. So God is, to some extent, again, carefully, by Job, on trial. Then, of course, when we think of the book of Job, excuse me, I got a sneeze coming on. I feel this thing coming, but you never make it on command, or on demand here. No, it went away. Okay, so Job is also on trial by his friends, and that's the thing we most often think about. We know that the first two chapters establish this foundation that Job is on trial by Satan, but, the great bulk of the book is his friends getting on his case and trying to prove, to their way of thinking, that he must be a sinner, and his denial thereof is a great crime. They're pretty insistent that he's making matters far worse by denying what they think is the obvious. You can't be suffering unless it's for a reason. That reason has to be sin. God is punishing you. If you're denying that, then you're in trouble with us. So the friends are there. Then, as you saw in this week's reading, it's our third week's reading. We had only a few chapters the first time and then about half the book. But as we come to the end, Elihu shows up. And this Elihu puts everybody on trial. He doesn't like what Job is saying. He doesn't like what any of the three friends are saying. And yet, surprisingly, as you do the reading this week, it doesn't appear to me like he really says anything much different than the friends have been saying. So he takes them to task, and he tries to establish himself as some sort of an authority in the matter, but he really isn't all that original in the argumentation that he's presenting either. All right, and then we have Job and the friends, finally, at the very end of the book, are judged by God. So God now appears, God renders his judgment, and there's no doubt about it, who's right, who's wrong. They all stand, the humans, in this awesome presence of God, and fearful, recognizing that they haven't understood what they should. Now, I put this little chart together because through the years, I have been looking at who's given the floor, and to what extent are they given the floor as these various witnesses are testifying. So I
noticed it, but I never really tried to digest it, you know, make a chart out of it like that right here. So when you break it down, Job himself, of course, is the primary speaker, and he is given some 20 and a half chapters. So right off the bat, you know that this book, which God wants to be a part of our Bibles, this book has got something to say in Job's mouth that God really wants us to see, and he wants us to see it at very great length. There's some kind of message here that's very important to God to devote 20 and a half chapters of your Bible to what Job has on his mind. More on that in a little bit. But then, the first of the speakers, the friends, is Eliphaz, the second is Bildad, and then Zophar, and as you can see, they are each given a little bit less time to plead their case. Eliphaz is going to speak three times, and he gets four chapters. Bildad will speak three times, he gets three chapters. Zophar is only going to speak twice, and he only gets two chapters. So I'm not sure why he got shorted. They had an idea, you know, in the commentary on the book right there, that Zophar didn't get quite as much, but, you know, we just don't know. But then, Elihu, rather surprisingly to me, is given six chapters. That's a lot. It's more than anybody else except Job. Elihu's on the floor testifying here, you know, more than God is himself. And so once again, at least we need to stop and say to ourselves, God wanted the book here. He wanted the book presented in the manner that it did. And while it's always kind of dangerous to think that just volume, you know, is telling you also relative importance, nonetheless, Elihu is given significantly more time to argue than anybody else in the book, save Job. And then at the end, God is the final judge. He doesn't need to speak long at all, even like in a typical trial. Do the witnesses do more talking? Do the lawyers do more talking? Or does the judge do more talking? Well, the judge hardly talks at all, does he? He just in the end says, here's my decision, and doesn't take very long at all. Likewise, God is passing judgment on all of them. There's only 3.5 chapters that are revealing God's position on the matter. Now, please open to Job chapter 27, and in your book here, that would be on page 925. So let's rehearse now in this week's reading what we already knew really about Job's position, but we want to see it reflected in the material that we've just been considering. So let's look at each one of these viewpoints. Job's position in the first six verses is reiterated. He's been stating it repeatedly already of chapter 27, page 925. Moreover, Job continued his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me, and the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say you, this is not directed at God, it's directed at the friends now, that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. Now, brethren, as you're looking at this page, you know, please note that chapter 26 there in its entirety is on that same page. With chapter 26, Job is beginning his final argumentation. So chapter 26, chapter 27, chapter 28, 29, 30, 31 is the longest speech that Job gives. And see how it ends on page 929 over in the right-hand column right there at the bottom above the transition. What do you get? Words of Job are ended. Okay? So that is the conclusion of his argumentation. I rest my case. Okay? Is what he has said right there. But now if you come back to page 925, as he's giving this summary, if you will, look at the beauty of the man's mind. He, in verse 2,
As God lives, who's taken away my justice, and the Almighty who's made my soul bitter, as long as my breath's in me, and the breath of God's in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, or my tongue utter deceit. Now, is it true that Job is not suffering because God is punishing him for sin? That is absolutely true. This is not the source of his suffering. Is it not also true, though, that he is right? His suffering is directly traceable to God's activity. Can he blame God for the circumstances? Now, I feel a bit of hesitation, and I think I know why that's happening. And I agree with you. Is Satan involved in this? Sure. Do we want to blame Satan for this? Well, yes, and rightly so. But when Satan comes with his charge, God could have said, well, you're wrong. Bye. It could have been that simple, but he didn't. So ultimately, who is responsible for Job's suffering? It's God. He turned it over.
Now that's as close to a perfect man as you can get without being Jesus Christ. And when God put him up before Satan, he says, look at my servant Job. He's perfect in all his ways. He was probably the most righteous man next to Jesus that ever lived.
That is the case. And appreciate you making the observation there. We've got one who... Enoch, who is taken up into heaven, that could compare for having lived a sin-free life. But you're right. Throughout the book, as a matter of fact, everything about Job is that he is righteous. God says so over and over again, and so he ought to be held up by us as a perfect example of the fact that you really can get the job done. It was totally unrelated here, but a few weeks ago I made a big point out of this in one of the other classes, is that we should pass what Jesus describes as a righteous judgment upon ourselves. And we should not think more highly than we ought to think, Paul will say, but how should we think? Think properly. See, we ought to be able to judge ourselves and then speak the truth about that judgment. And hopefully there's someone among us who can say that the grand and great and overriding characteristic of my life is not sin. I'm doing a pretty good job of trying to be what God would have me to be. Job is doing a spectacular job at it. And now the second thing I want to say about these verses is starting now with verse 5. So he's first four verses declared, I will not, as long as breath is in me, speak wickedness, nor will my tongue utter deceit. Even though in the first couple of verses, it is God that took away justice, it is God that made his soul bitter. Now, think about this for a minute. Is it fair? Is it just? Is it right that Job should have to suffer like this? Really, no. I don't think by anybody's standard. Satan is falsely accusing him. God is allowing him to be tested, but he didn't earn this. He didn't deserve this, to the point that Bill's just been making. Still, I am not going to sin, he says, even in that circumstance. So now, I was going to get 5 and 6, but no thought just hit me. Brethren, why should we serve God in our lives? And if there was no heaven in it at the end, would you and should you still serve God? Would he not still deserve exactly and everything that he's already asking of us, whether he gives us heaven or not? Does God owe you heaven? Does he owe any creature which he has made heaven? No! He is the master. He is the Lord. He is the creator. He makes all the rules. He can do whatever he wants with his creation. And the fact that he made us does not make it incumbent upon him that he take anybody to heaven, even if they'd never sinned. Now, he reveals that this is the setup. He wants us to go to heaven. He will reward us with heaven. We need to be forgiven of our sins. Jesus died on our behalf. Also, we could go to that place. But suppose, you know, we got our 67th book of the Bible next week, and it says, I, Yahweh, have changed my mind. There's no heaven for anybody after all. New program. When you die, you're like Rover. You get all over. I know. What then? Big decision, wouldn't it? Big decision time. Should I still serve God? Job seems to be getting the point. Well, sure you should. You should still serve God, and for two reasons. Number one, he deserves it. But number two, the things that God asks of us, the things that he requires of us in our lives, are they in our best interest? Will you lead a happier life if you follow his advice? Will there be just oceans of trouble that you'll be able to avoid if you live your life the way God tells you to? So even if there's no heaven, isn't it better for you to obey God while you're still living under the sun? Well, sure it is. Okay? So Job gets the picture, and even though justice has been removed, even though God has made his soul bitter there in the end of verse 2, he's still not going to sin against him. Now 5 and 6, and this will lend itself to what Bill said a moment ago. Far be it from me that I should say you are right, you the friends. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast. I will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. So what kind of a backbone is this guy got? He's outnumbered, really, 4-1. Because he lied, he just got his licks to get in. They're all telling him he's wrong. And here as he starts this last speech, and where's Job ended when he gets done right here, what is his position? Unchanged. That kind of confidence in yourself is also a good thing. People ought to know where they stand before their God and then occupy that ground, and peer pressure should be meaningless in the face of God's instruction and your integrity. Okay? Never yield. Carol?
It seems to me that if God knew the outcome of everything before he even created, that he knows that Satan is going to do this anyway. So the reason that he's doing this is that human beings always have the feelings that are being expressed here that you must have been doing something wrong. Because when something happens wrong in somebody's life, and people might say, well, God, somebody says something, and you say, well, they'll say, God let this happen. Well, yes, God let this happen to Job, but that's part of the experience of living. I mean, that's what he gave to us, was free will. And this lesson has nothing to do with him giving permission to Satan or not, because I think Satan would have done it, because Satan was going to do what he did with Christ in the end. So Satan could have done all of this to Job without God being the arbitrator there and God watching over him.
If I understand what Carol is saying, you know, you're right. Whether or not Satan had ever appeared and made this big case, you know, over Job in particular, does Satan tempt everybody? Is Satan the source of all problems that you have in the world today? He is ultimately responsible for all of that stuff. And so it's absolutely correct. Job was still, he was already being tried and tested and having problems, you know, with Satan before this grand one takes place here as revealed in the book. Job's case is what? How many of you know the term case law? You know what case law is? Okay. Well, Job is the case that does what?
Kind of sets the standard, doesn't it? It proves all the point. It sets the standard. This is the one, you know, where we render our judgments, and from this on, you know, all things flow. And so that's what it becomes ultimately.
Everybody's going to be tested. Everybody's going to have problems. But it's Job's case that's becoming the law. It is also the ultimate case. Nobody suffered like him either. And so it's proven human beings will serve God whether or not life is easy. Job proves that. And human beings can serve God flawlessly in the sight of God. Job proves that as well. And they can do it in the face of peer pressure, which is the number one thing, I think, that causes most people to fail anyway. Okay, so any comment or question there just on those six verses? Let's just hit another one here also in chapter 27. So turn the page, and over on 926, there at the end of this 27th chapter now, starting at verse 20. That should be 20 to 23, not 28. I see. I need to fix that slide. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. Men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. Okay, Jenny came in and she said, what's this clapping that's going on in the book of Job here? Okay, well, you know, what is Job's position here in these verses, 27, verses 20 and following? Well, man has a tough time. Terrors and tempests and east winds and doesn't spare anything. He flees desperately from its power. Men clap their hands at him and hiss him out of his place. So her question was, how is this clapping being used? Typically, when we clap, what do we mean? You know, hooray, good for you, I approve, you did, you know, a superior job, and so, you know, that's great. But if I hiss at you, what does that mean? What's the word we add to the front of hiss most often? Boo, you know, boo, hiss. All right, well, this clapping is exactly that as well. And so, more that Hebrew poetry where both mean exactly the same thing. That's odd to us, but in their culture, you know, that's what's taking place in this context. While I was standing back there talking to Jimmy, can you think of any other way that we clap rather than just say, hey, hooray, you did a great job? How do mothers sometimes clap? Now, it only takes one. What's that mean? Pay attention, because it's also a warning of what in most cases? You're going to get one of these, you know, if you don't take care of business right here. I had a picture. I didn't do this one with Jimmy a few minutes ago. But you ever see people, you farmers, clapping at chickens? What are they doing? You're hurting them now. Okay, so clapping is used in a wide variety of ways. We kind of get stuck on this one, but in this context, when he says men clap their hands at him, it was some form of an expression that says, like you do with that recalcitrant child, you know, you're out of line.
It's also in 34. Verse 37.
I'm sorry, what was the reference again, Jimmy?
34.
Chapter 34?
Yeah.
Chapter 34, verse 27.
39. I have seen it twice, and I thought it had probably the same context.
I'm still not catching the second verse reference.
37.
Chapter
34,
verse
37.
Okay, there you go. All right, he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Now, well, let's get back to verse 34. I think somebody used that. 34 now. Men of understanding say to me, wise men who listen to me, Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without wisdom. Oh, that Job were tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of wicked men. So you already know what's on Elihu's mind. Is he agreeing with Job in any way? He said, every word out of his mouth is like those of wicked men. For he adds, rebellion to his sin, he, who's the he referred to? Job claps his hands among us. Who's the us? Three friends and Elihu. And multiplies his words against God. So in this case, it is a picture of Job clapping his hands against the four speakers, again, to show disapproval rather than, as we would ordinarily use it, as approval. Okay, and then next, let's go to chapter 30 then, so back up just a couple of pages. I'm just trying to pick out some representative expressions in this last speech of Job's where he is establishing where he stands. So in chapter 30 and verses 20 through 23, 30:20 is on page 928 right there in the middle. I cry out to you, and you can see the capital Y, he is addressing God, but you do not answer me. I stand up and you regard me, but you've become cruel to me. With the strength of your hand you oppose me. You lift me up to the wind and cause me to ride on it. You spoil my success, for I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. Now, brethren, that's pointed, isn't it? He's addressing God. And what is he saying? You've wrecked my life. Every bit of my success you've ruined. Was it true? Yes, but that's Satan's testing insistence. Okay, but it is true. And what he's saying there then is, I'm innocent, but God has ruined me. And ultimately in verse 23, what's going to happen to me? I'm going to die. We've seen this in the preceding lessons as well. He fully expected to die, and apparently pretty soon. The description of his diseases and injuries and the suffering that he's going through is so extreme that repeatedly he prays to die, he asks to die, he curses the day he was born, wishing it had never happened, and then time and again, you know, he's asking God, just end it, just take me off this planet. And so ultimately he thinks that he's going to die in the course of this, and it's inevitable, so let's just hasten the thing. Okay, now, I know you can't read these right here, but everybody turn over to, well, it's that page, 928 is chapter 31. And then what I did, verses 5, 9, I'm just doing this for the tape, 13, 16, 19, 21, 24, 25, 26, 29, 33, and then 38 and following, but what's the first thing you see at every one of those verses in chapter 31? If. Okay? So look at 31. We'll look through the first three there, 5, 9, and 13. 31, 5. If I've walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, then what does 6 say? Judge it. Let me be weighed on a scale that God may know my integrity. So if I've done this, if I walk with falsehood, if I ever hasten to deceit, name it and punish it if I ever have. Go on to verse 9. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I've lurked at my neighbor's door, what's verse 10? Then punish. Skip to verse 13. If I've despised the cause of my male or female servant, verse 16, if I kept kept the poor from their desire or caused the eyes of the widow to fail. 19, if I've seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, point being I didn't help them. 20, if his heart has not blessed me, if he's not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I've raised my hand against the fatherless. 24, if I've made gold my hope. 25, if I've rejoiced because of my wealth. 26, if I've observed the sun when it shines and the moon moving in brightness so that my heart's been secretly enticed. What was that a reference to in that session? What's he talking about? Idolatry, apparently. If I'd been enticed to worship pay tribute, you know, to the sun, the moon, the stars. And it goes on and on and on through all the verses that I've listed right there. So let's summarize it then in verses 38 through 40, 9:29, right-hand column at the bottom. If my land cries out against me, and its furrows weep together, if I've eaten its fruit without money or caused its owners to lose their lives, then let thistles grow instead of wheat, and weeds instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. So what he does is go through this long list of examples. If I ever sin in any conceivable way, let me give you a dozen and a half of them. If ever that, then prove it and punish me. I'll take it. Brethren, wow, this list. Job's just examined every aspect of his life, the way he treats everybody around him. The last one is the people that work for me. You know, the land's crying out because I withheld their wages. But he is from top to bottom. He has been examining his life, his whole life probably, but most especially while this has been going on, and he finds no wrong in himself. Well, good for him. What a guy. Bill pointed it out. He is just absolutely righteous. So, the words of Job are ended. And by the way, through all these chapters, we've had three of his friends talking so far. Two of them spoke three times. One of them spoke twice. Okay? They've had nine chapters distributed among them. Did they ever find a sin in that man's life? Nary one. They all utterly failed. They were insistent that there must be one. They wouldn't take no for an answer. But could they demonstrate one? Could they identify one? Could they adduce one, you know, as an example? Absolutely not. So let's talk about the friend's position for a minute, which is really simple, and I'm not even going to read a single verse. What's their position? You're a sinner. What's their evidence? We can say it so well. Listen to these nine chapters. How beautifully we can say you're a sinner. And the you know, great argumentation that God punishes sinners. Does God punish sinners? Yes, he does. Do sin-free people sometimes suffer? What would the friend say? Never. Can't happen. Yeah. Not a clue what he's talking about. Do you have another comment?
And Job says, the words are like wind. They have no substance.
Amen. They can't find a single example. I saw a movement back there, Ted. Were you trying to get my attention?
I was just going to say, verse 32, chapter 3, pretty much sums up what he's talking about.
Read it to us. Amen. See, we get that several times. So you're a sinner. Well, he isn't. So now we get this Elihu. And Elihu shows up to give us six chapters, more than any other speaker, save Job. And he, in chapter 32 now, we're just going to read the first nine verses, that which begin over on page 930. So let's read these first nine verses, chapter 32. So, these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Was Job righteous in his own eyes? Yes, he was. But usually if you say somebody's righteous in their own eyes, what do we mean? They're the only eyes that think so. See? And there's some arrogance, there's some pride involved there. So I suspect that while it's okay and it's proper for Job to be righteous in his own eyes, this is meant as an expression of how these guys felt, and in their minds, this phrase is a criticism. He's arrogant. He's conceited. In his own eyes, he thinks he's so great. In their eyes, were they able to identify a single sin? He should have been righteous in their eyes, too. But they're accusing him of a crime, and then they've got no evidence. So then, verse 2, the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, was aroused, how? Against Job. So right up front, we are told what his attitude is. He's angry, His anger is aroused at Job. His wrath, it then says, was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. Now again, let's be careful here. Did Job justify himself? Yes. Now did he justify himself rather than God? Not really. He had a criticism for God. God, I don't deserve this, I don't understand this, this isn't fair. But is he justifying himself, you know, instead of God? No, really not that at all. So again, Elihu's anger here is misplaced. Also, verse 3, against his three friends his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. So as Ted just read, you know, they were helpless to prove their case, but they sure argued it eloquently. And now verse 4 is kind of fun. Because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited to speak to Job. And then skipping to the last half there of verse 6, the indented part, I'm young in years, and you're very old. Okay. Now, that really is quite the clue there, and it does help us out. Job's three friends, and they've come a far distance, and they stayed 3 days in silence. You know, was it 3 days or seven? Anyway, they were close friends. So likely they're of the same age, aren't they? Okay, and it's right for us, I think, to recognize that Elihu here is just simply stating an historical fact. Job's had a long life at this point, and so have the three friends. So when Elihu says very old, he, I think, is just stating a simple fact. But, therefore, I was afraid, dared not declare my opinion to you. I said, age should speak, and multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there is a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. Great men are not always wise, nor do the aged understand justice. Has he said anything wrong so far? I don't think so. He's nailed it. He's a young guy. They are very old men. He doesn't like anything he's heard from three friends or Job either. And he was respectful. He apparently been gnawing his tongue for some time there. You know, he speaks of it at length, in fact, how hard it was for him to keep his mouth shut. It was just tormenting his spirit. And finally, as young men are wont to do, he cuts it loose. So he's going to speak his piece there. So Elihu's position is, you're all of you wrong, and it's just tormenting me to listen to you. So for six chapters, let me just rip into all of you. Okay? But as I say, I don't want to spend much time on his speeches, because to me, they don't seem to really add much to the issue there. All he's arguing, much like the three friends, without, you know, sufficient evidence, is you're all wrong. Job, you're wrong. I take you to task first. You three other guys, you're all wrong too. But he hasn't got any more evidence to prove his point than any of the others. So now, we're going to come down to the end here. Finally, God's judgment. And we got this big trial. Job's on trial by Satan. God's on trial by Job. Job's on trial by three friends. The three friends and Job are on trial by Elihu. You know, we've just got all this judgment going on. Finally, God's going to put everybody on trial. So let's come on over to chapter 42, last chapter in the book, which is over here on page 939, if you have a chronological Bible. And let's just start reading in the right-hand column there at verse 7. And so it was, after Yahweh had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, he was the first of the three friends to speak. God addresses him first now too. My wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as what? My servant Job has. Did Job, in 20 and a half chapters, speak right? He sure enough did, didn't he? There it is. God says so. Now therefore, take for yourselves seven bulls and seven rams. Go to my servant Job and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. For I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly. Because you have not spoken of me what is right, as what? My servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite, went and did as the Lord commanded them. For the Lord had accepted Job, in case you weren't convinced yet. And the Lord restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. Indeed, Yahweh gave Job twice as much as he had before. Now, brethren, I hope I'm not reading more into this than is there. I grant that it could just be a matter of historical accuracy, and we're just talking about, you know, what happened. But it looks to me like, in verse 10, the Lord restored Job's losses when? That the restoration of his losses is somehow tied to this prayer and this sacrifice. Now think for a minute, what is this last thing then that God is asking of Job? He's already taken everything he owns, or allowed Satan to do it. He's tormented him just brutally in the flesh with all kinds of physical suffering. You know, but there's this one more thing he's just asked Job to do. What is it? I want you to offer a sacrifice for your friends. Now, if you're offering a sacrifice, what are you doing? You offer a sacrifice for what reason ever? To atone. Ask for forgiveness. To appeal to God to accept your prayer. So, like I said, I hope I'm not reading too much into this, because it might just be a simple historical fact that, you know, that's when it happened. But I'm thinking it's more likely tied. After all of this, Job's been blistered by these guys for 9 chapters, and then Elihu adds 6 more to that. And what does God ask Job to do? Pray for them. Yeah, they've been mistreating him for what looks to be hours. Pray for him, Job. And he does. Amen.
And whether or not, I don't think I'm really reading too much into it, but I think Job knew it was his place to make the sacrifice for his friends to save them.
Okay, and he does. He does. So in the remainder of 10, indeed, Yahweh gave Job twice as much as he had before. And all his brothers, all his sisters, all those who had been his acquaintances before, remember he had said they'd abandoned him too, came to him, ate food with him in his house. They consoled and comforted him for all the adversity that Yahweh had brought upon him. Each one gave him a piece of silver and each a ring of gold. Now the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning, for he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 female donkeys, 7 sons and 3 daughters, and then we get the names of the daughters, 15 in all the land. Were found no women so beautiful as the daughters of Job, and their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. So apparently these daughters were as pretty as my 2 granddaughters. Okay. And it's, you know, that's fine and great in the way it ought to be. We take pleasure in that beauty. We're proud of that beauty. It is an honor to be in the presence of such beauty. And so he gets more children. He gets beautiful children. He gets children that bring him pleasure and joy and satisfaction. And then 16, after this, Job lived 140 years, saw his children and grandchildren for 4 generations. So Job died old and full of days, and I guess, because he was 140 years after Elihu said he was what?
Very old.
Well, I know what Elihu thought very old was, but whatever it was, you had to tack it on to 140 years. So, what is God's judgment of Job? You did fine, Job. You did okay. Now, what's his judgment in the same verses on those 3 friends? Okay, not so good at all. Offer the sacrifice. Now,
I don't want to leave a mistaken impression here. in this speech, has God got anything, any criticism to offer of Job? No. Had God offered some criticism of Job, though?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. See, starting in 38, when God first speaks, who is this darkest knowledge? You know, Job, you don't have any idea what you're talking about. Now, when Job's examining his own life, does he have every idea what he's talking about? Hey, he's absolutely right. Okay? But when he is saying, God, you're not fair. All this time tonight, I've been saying, asked you repeatedly, you agreed with me, God was not being fair. Now, let's be very narrow in our focus and make sure we clarify that one, too. Was God being fair in the sense that Job is being punished for something that he didn't do? Well, that sounds unfair. If you punish somebody for something they didn't do, that's unfair. But was it unjust for God to allow Satan to test Job like this? You cannot charge God with the sin of injustice ultimately in the event that took place. With the narrow focus of Job, no, he didn't sin. All the friends of Elihu are wrong. God does not punish exclusively because of sin and always because of sin, so that if you're suffering, you must be a sinner. All of that is false. So, yeah, it was kind of unfair that a righteous man should have to suffer if you're just thinking about the man. But God had every right to do this. God did do this. He was just and righteous in doing this. And so what was, see if you can just give for me an idea, why did God allow all of this?
We have no answer.
Carol?
I'm going to say that one of the points that I see from this story is that God is telling us that all four friends judged Job unrighteously without a shred of evidence. His wife does the same and says, curse God and die. All of his relatives and everybody who on absolutely no knowledge, they judged in God's place. And my takeaway from this time is that we focus so much on Job and the trials that he did. I think the whole lesson is how bad we human beings do things.
Evaluate.
And it's not just that Job was righteous and unworthy of the test, it's that we fail. Every single other human being fails.
Okay, now amen. Everything you said is absolutely true. Okay, but I'm digging this a little bit deeper because absolutely everything you said was predicated on something is what I'm looking for. Okay, back here for Mark.
So I see it as coming from First Peter chapter 1 when God was in the conversation with Satan and he said, "Have you considered my servant Job that there is none like him on the earth, blameless and upright man? One who fears God and shuns evil. For God to say that about one of his creations is unheard of and amazing thing. And so it is God's great confidence in Job to set him before that trial to say, this is my warrior, keep yours. And for me, it is, all right, Job was a real man. He was like me. And if I can be as close to Job as I can, what's that going to be like?
And all of that is exactly right. And it's predicated on this thing that only Margaret knows.
His faith was an example to the people around him.
Job was an example to the people around you. Okay. That is also it. Now, here's what I'm looking for, though. Did there have to be the book? Satan came, said, hey, look at this. God said, okay. Did God have to write the book?
No.
Could have all this gone on and we never knew it. But why did all this happen? So the book could be written. And now all these lessons that the three of you are talking about, how do you know those things? Because Job passed the test, and God wanted a book written about it. So we get to see the lawyers and the witnesses and watch this whole trial and everybody elaborately developing their argumentation. We get to see all of this because God wanted Job to suffer, apparently, not just so Satan would get the point, but what? So we would get Carol's point and Mark's point, Margaret's point, so people would be able to learn this thing. Job was selected by God because God had every confidence that he could pass this test. I think I mentioned this once before in 4 years I've been here, but one of the very first sermons, it might have been the first sermon I ever preached, it was called, Would God Have Chosen You? And then what I did was I went through and I just picked a number of characters from both the Old and the New Testaments and quickly developed what they did. Okay? But in every case, what was going on? God had a purpose in asking this person to do this thing. And then another sermon that was one of my very first ever sermons, it just came together this way, I'll show you something about the frame of mind I was in so long ago, you know, was not only would God have chosen you, but the faith that God has in us, in human beings. Much of the Bible, of course, is only talking about faith that we have in Him. We tend to think only in terms of man has faith in God. Man has faith, you know, in trials and all of that. Did God have faith that Job could do this? God believed in Job. He believed in Job sufficiently that he could say to Satan, give it your worst shot. Just destroy him. Kill his children. Take everything he owns. Have his wife turn against you, God. You know, and when the wife turns against God, does Job? No, now you talk about peer pressure. That's some serious peer pressure when your wife comes and says, you still going to be faithful to this God? You know, cursing and God. Job faced all of it. Why? Because God believed in Job. So, would God have chosen you? I need a Job. Satan comes and, well, that was an Old Testament character. I've never seen a Christian put in a test like this. Let's see if they can do it. Linda? It's your turn.
Nehemiah would say, bring it on. You know, brother, I think those are just great lessons.
Job suffered what he did so that you and I can learn from this experience. You can be righteous. You can withstand any trial, no matter how horrible it is. You can have faith in the absence of any explanation on why the stuff that's going on in your life is happening. You can be faithful if everybody turns against you. Job is all these things because the book got written when Satan came for his own purposes to argue this case. God permitted it. Now, I'm quite sure he only permitted it because he had faith in Job. And he wanted us to see that faith was well placed.
I thought that was interesting. I know Joe told the three friends that if this had been me, I would have made you feel better and all of that. And they're the ones that he was asked to pray for. But we don't have anything about Elihu.
Yeah, and that was the next thing I was just getting into. Read my mind here. Okay, what was God's judgment on Elihu? Isn't that interesting? God never mentions Elihu at all. He's specific about the three friends, and they're named, and I want them to, you know, offer a sacrifice. But about Elihu, God says nothing. I cannot tell you why, but Jenny can tell.
Maybe because they're not giving God a credit. They believe in other things, life itself, and you've got to be that because you've committed a sin. So their whole philosophy was wrong. Elihu just wants to speak his peace. He said, y'all are not wise at all. You're just dumb.
And as a matter of fact, he's right in that regard.
Yeah.
But he wasn't any wiser than they were, was he? I don't know.
And
maybe there's your lesson for all you younger folks in the room.
But his three friends knew him.
young man didn't know intimately for years. He didn't have that test of trial. So the guilt goes to those who really knew him and should have been able to judge.
Carol's got a great point. Elihu is kind of speaking philosophically because he's admitting, I'm a very young man and you're a very old man, and so you guys know Job, and Job knows you, but I'm just kind of a Johnny-come-lately observer here. So he speaks in kind of philosophical terms. The others should have had evidence. And the evidence was, Job, you're acquitted. You are not guilty. I don't know what God's doing, but you are not guilty. We've been watching you for decades. Jimmy?
But he may not know him because he was in the city and he was a great man and everybody went to him and respected him and
everything that he did. Well, I agree completely. He was the greatest man in the East. Everybody knew who Job was. And in fact, in his list of if I've done this or that, you know, it involved all kinds of people all over everywhere. He was the best known guy that there was. But as far as being a friend, you know, intimately acquainted with him. How many of you know who Hillary Clinton is? Okay. Now, you've all formed an opinion. Is it based on personal experience? What do you know about Hillary Clinton? So, you could confidently vote for Trump because you do know him. We don't know him any better than you know her. See? But the difference is, you know the people in this room. You have evidence about how they live their lives because you're observing that. Those people are utter strangers to us.
I don't know anything about their lives. I know what other people say about their lives. I know what the news reports, you know, say, but I don't know them. And it looks to me like Elihu's coming at it that way. So Jimmy's right. I mean, everybody knows him, and Elihu knows him, but he doesn't know him, you know, as a friend, as a man. Okay, now I just want to close very quickly. If you want to grab your pencils, because I'm out of time, I just want to show you, brethren, there is in chapter 38, verses 6 and 7, this expression about the sons of God. Now, God speaks, and I've skipped most of that tonight because you're all familiar with God, what he did there, naming his power and how Job was helpless to do any of those things or even understand them. So in Job 38, 6 and 7, on what were its bases the earth sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? I really disliked the commentary that the editors added there about this being a common term for deities or divinities. Certainly not in Job's world, not in the Jews' world, is that the case at all. So then, if you just want to jot it down, here is every occurrence of that expression in your Bible. It has already occurred twice in Job. It occurs in Job 1, verse 6. It occurs in Job chapter 2, verse 1. We've got those sons of God there as well. They appear in Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4. And in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, quite erroneously, misunderstood the passage entirely, people say that they must be angels or they're some kind of superhuman beings and all of this. That's not the point of it at all in that passage, but they're just not properly understanding the passage. Note, for instance, the term now in the New Testament where Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be supernatural angels. I didn't see anything like that. He said, blessed are peacemakers, they shall be called sons of God. So can you be a son of God? Sure you can. You don't have to sprout wings, you know, or work miracles to do it. In Luke chapter 20, verses 35 and 36, you have that term again. And he says, because they're like angels, they are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. Now they're sons of God if you are approved before God at the resurrection. And then the last two here, very helpful. In Romans chapter 8, verses 14 and 15, all who are being led by the Spirit of God, these are what? Well, it doesn't make you a divinity. It doesn't make you, you know, an idolatrous god in Egypt like they suggested. And then the last one here, Romans 8, two in Romans, 8 verses 18 through 23. The anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. Well, it's a judgment passage that would be related to the resurrection one we just read about in the Roman letter. But the simple solution to all this is Galatians 3:26. You're all sons of God through what? Through faith in Christ Jesus. This term, sons of God, has to do with those who believe in and serve God. And it's not limited to witnesses of the creation, such as the angels, any of us who are serving God
are sons of God. Sons and daughters, of course, children of God. Okay, any comment or question? Read on, ye.